In the coming week, a diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Winter Olympics stirs new tensions. Former President Donald Trump kicks off his history tour, and Russian President Putin delivers his annual Constitution Day address amid rising Russia-Ukraine tensions. It's December 9th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, this week the Biden administration announced that it will stage a diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics, which are set to be hosted in Beijing this coming February. American athletes will still compete in the Games, but no U.S. government officials or delegates will travel to Beijing to attend them. A statement from the White House cited the Chinese Communist Party's ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang province as the reason for the diplomatic boycott. Bob, can you tell us a bit more about the Biden administration's decision-making and what signals this sends or doesn't send to China and the rest of the world?
Well, Jim, they had been signaling this was probably going to be the case for a bit of time, even before, I believe, the latest incident involving a Chinese tennis player who had accused a former senior Chinese leader of sexual assault. That's the case of Peng Shui. So even before that, there had been signals that concern over Chinese actions in Xinjiang were enough that the U.S. was going to diplomatically boycott these games. So they went forward with it. And we should say, you know, that they went forward with it as China faced new scrutiny and questions over its handling of the Peng Shui case. She still has not been seen on her own volition, I believe, since the Twitter post that she made, and then that was quickly withdrawn. Although there have been sightings of her on videos that were sort of carefully controlled and encounters with the IOC, among other things. So it's all part of a piece of ongoing U.S. concerns, though, about Xinjiang, which have been consistent, and the U.S. has been out in the forefront in these concerns. There have been reports from human rights groups and other studies of what's happening in Xinjiang, including reports of forced sterilizations of ethnic Uyghurs, who are the Muslim minority that's in the majority in Xinjiang. And so it's a way of trying to raise pressure. I should note, Jim, that after this, a couple of other countries have joined in the diplomatic boycott, Australia and Canada, which have had their own diplomatic tensions with China of recent. The UK said that there would be no UK ministers attending the games, although China had said they were not invited in the first place. Lithuania, according to some reports, has announced officials will not be attending the games. And so this has, as expected, stirred a strong reply from China. It signaled rather ominously to the US that it would pay a price for this action. We'll have to see whether that's a short-term or a longer-term thing. I would note in 2028, the US itself hosts the summer games in LA. Maybe we might see some sort of reprisal on those lines, hearkening back to a broader boycott that happened in the 1980 Moscow Games by the U.S. and then follow up by the Soviet boycott in the L.A. Games in 84.
Should we make anything, Bob, of the fact that the diplomatic boycott was announced on the eve of the Biden administration hosting its democracy summit, which China most notably was not invited to?
I think the timing is worth noting, Jim, although we should say there are so many things going on in the diplomatic space between the U.S. and China, involving the U.S. and its allies, vis-a-vis China, Russia, and all sorts of countries. And we'll get to the latter a little bit later. But I do think it is significant. The games don't begin until February 4th. So announcing this and having that out there as countries assemble, as we are taping this podcast, that summit is kicking off, the two-day summit, Jim. And so one would imagine there's some comments to be made, or certainly media inquiries made to those assembled for this virtual summit. More than 100 countries have been invited to it. As you said, not China or Russia. And there have been a lot of questions about other countries left off of the list. But it's supposed to be about a pulling together of sort of like-minded countries, countries that are supposed to be respecting but also defending human rights issues and speaking out strongly on genocide. China is going to be in the air as this summit gets underway, Jim. So I think the timing is significant.
I will note, Bob, that the idea of democracy still is important. Beijing responded to not being invited to the Biden Democracy Summit, not by attacking democracy, but insisting that it has a distinctive form of democracy, one that is dealing better than Western forms of democracy with challenges like the pandemic. But I want to ask you, Bob, in terms of the decision to do this, to boycott diplomatically the Olympic Games, is there a downside for the Biden administration? Is there a potential that this is going to make it even harder to work with China on issues that matter to the United States?
That's one of the big questions and part of the debate that's stirred by this kind of a move. And it's a question that China raises in particular, given its record, given its doubling down on its actions that are seen as disturbing, if not offensive, to many countries in the West. Let's look at its crackdown on democracy in Hong Kong, well ahead of the scheduled, you know, changes that were supposed to be taking place in Hong Kong as part of the one country, two systems approach. That's one example. What China has done in Tibet in terms of what some people have termed cultural genocide. China's actions, its assertiveness in all sorts of other places, its media censorship, and really kind of throwing its weight around at the UN and in international fora now. China has really gone on the offensive, and whatever actions countries take vis-a-vis China now encounter a whole level of new scrutiny, even I would say beyond what was involved in the days of the Soviet Union, the Cold War, because of China's integration into the global economy, certainly. And, you know, everybody has some sort of a meaningful economic relationship with China, it seems. Many of the countries at the Democracy Summit, for example. And so there are consequences. And China has showed it is not shirking away from using its leverage to try to influence hearts and minds. It showed this in its distribution of vaccines. We should note some countries in, let's say, in South America that had relations with Taiwan, you know, were basically said, you know, you drop those relations or this large shipment of vaccines is not coming your way. Many, many instances of these types of messages are coming from China. And so I think as it concerns the U.S., it's a much bigger relationship, obviously. But I do think it's seen as maybe adding a little bit more attention to a relationship that President Xi and Biden were seen as having managed a little bit, where they had carved out areas of disagreement, but also trying to cite areas where they could work together. So will this mean that suddenly China and the U.S. can't work in common cause? We'll have to see. I will note, Jim, that one thing that's happened most recently as tensions were percolating was China joining the U.S. in deploying a strategic reserve of oil, and a move that, you know, was seen as counter to OPEC's supply practices. So it seems like China can compartmentalize sometimes what it's trying to do, even if the U.S. is involved.
Bob, we have perhaps skipped over an important foundational question, which is why should China care if an American vice president or assistant secretary for East Asian Affairs is or isn't in Beijing to watch the games?
The people who criticize the move on other grounds, Jim, say it's basically half measures. Okay, you don't send an official delegation, but so what? The athletes are still there. China still gets to host the games that will take place with full participation and so forth. But the fact of announcing this, the fact of calling attention to China's record on human rights does register with China. And from what we've seen with the initial sort of strong reaction about consequences, again, we'll see what the consequences are. China does not like to be called out in this way. They vehemently defend their record and they vehemently defend their right to carry out their internal affairs as they see fit.
To repress people as they see fit.
Whether it's repressing people as they see fit, all sorts of measures that China takes that are seen as outside of international norms. You will see a consistent Chinese approach to trying to mitigate against what they call interventions in internal affairs. They do this constantly in the UN Security Council, but in all sorts of other fora as well. Jim, I should also just note that this month marks 20 years since China's accession to the World Trade Organization, in which the fervent hope was that it would be joining a body at which it would become a quote-unquote stakeholder in terms of observing the WTO's rules, observing trade rules. It has been found by many competitors to be not observing those rules, that it has taken advantage of the opening of markets while not necessarily reining in its own practices in terms of whether you talk about dumping steel supplies or subsidizing state firms. I should also note, Jim, that in 2008, there was a lot of concern registered about China hosting the Summer Games. That was seen as its big coming out party. And there were a number of practices, not in Xinjiang, but other concerns raised about China's movement against dissidents, people who were speaking out, people who were holding demonstrations. And, the expectation was, okay, well, let's bring China into the fold. And the sort of constructive engagement thought that China would change its behavior as it became more part of international system. That certainly has not been the case.
Certainly has been, Bob. And I don't know anyone who's going to be celebrating Saturday's anniversary of China's entry into the WTO.
Yes, Jim. Well, one of the people who is not a fan of the WTO session is former U.S. President Donald Trump. And he's going to be carrying out a self-styled history tour in the coming week. That's set to kick off in Florida. He's going to be accompanied by former Fox News host Bill O'Reilly. And then in Texas, there will be two more events in which he's going to discuss the 4 years of the Trump presidency. Jim, give us a sense of the significance of this tour at this time, and why should we be paying attention?
Well, we should be paying attention, Bob, because the odds are good that Donald Trump will be the Republican presidential candidate in 2024. If he does, he'll be seeking to match Grover Cleveland as the only president to serve non-consecutive terms in office. And even if Trump ultimately decides against running. He certainly casts a long shadow over the Republican Party. So what he says has potentially significant consequences, both for domestic politics and foreign policy. Now, remember, he's banned from Twitter, which used to be his go-to method for reaching the people. He's also done relatively few interviews since leaving the White House. So in a way, this history tour is Donald Trump returning to the main stage. The media, no doubt, are going to be paying a lot of attention to how many people are in the seats at these various arenas. Now, that's probably fitting because, as you know, Bob, Donald Trump is always pointing to crowd size as an indication of his success. Tickets for the history tour went on sale last June, and 6 months later, plenty of seats are still available. I actually checked to see what you could get at the Amway Center event in Orlando this Sunday, and more than 100 tickets are still available to sit on the main floor in front of the stage. Now, one of the reasons why tickets are still available may be their steep price. It's $100 for an entry-level ticket, and the premium tickets go up into the thousands of dollars. So while I think you're going to get a lot of attention by the media on sort of whether people show up for the event, I think it's going to be more interesting to listen to what he actually says. You know, the four events are billed, as you note, as Donald Trump and Bill O'Reilly discussing how things were accomplished in the Trump presidency. But we know from history that Donald Trump frequently goes off script. He doesn't necessarily answer the questions asked. So this tour could be less of a retrospective on his presidency and more the opening salvo of the 2024 presidential campaign. Now, of course, we're not really used to having former presidents throwing themselves into the political fray. For all of our lifetimes, the norm has been for presidents to leave the White House, to lead relatively quiet post-presidential careers, perhaps writing their memoirs, devoting themselves to good deeds, maybe taking up a hobby like painting and the rest, not working to get themselves behind the Resolute Desk in the White House. I do expect that in the four events, you're going to see heavy repetition of the big lie, and it is a lie that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. I doubt that Bill O'Reilly is going to act as a fact checker in that conversation. And I think that's a big problem. It's a problem because it's deeply destructive to American democracy. Barton Gellman, a journalist, has a piece out this week in The Atlantic that goes into great detail about how the lie of the election being stolen has been embraced by so many members of the Republican electorate, and they are essentially impervious to the overwhelming evidence that talk of a stolen election simply isn't true. And again, if you get no question when people don't believe election results are legitimate, it is hard to see how a democracy can function.
Jim, I think one of the things that piece, one of the issues that piece raised and was raised in other pieces, that one of the other ones that comes to mind is the Robert Kagan piece, I think in the Washington Post, and others in various fora have been the levels to which Republican office holders are being sworn to fealty to what's being called the big lie, which is that the elections were stolen. So you're having county level Republican officials vetted. You have a big race now looming and seemingly looming in Georgia, the state of Georgia, where Republican officials notably rebuffed the president's attempts to try to alter the result there. And then Georgia was a big upset for Democrats in 2020. So I think you're right. I think the history tour is liable to be a history of 2020 election tour rather than looking at Trump's accomplishments, which isn't a shame in some way, because I think you will find some Republicans and others who will say, let's look at the record. There are some interesting things to note there, pro and con, but it's all being overshadowed by a real threat to U.S. democracy. And again, the Democracy Summit that we've cited, many people have noted that it should start with some sort of U.S. doubling down on its own democracy and trying to make sure that its vote and the right to vote is protected.
Well, certainly, Bob, in terms of Donald Trump talking about his own record, he could point to the fact that Joe Biden is continuing a fair number of his policies, particularly on China, but also, interestingly, on immigration. So there's certainly a lot of fair criticism that can be had and fair retrospective on the Trump administration. But I do think you're right on this point that so many Republican officials and people who want to be Republican officials are in thrall in service of this lie that the election was stolen. You mentioned Georgia. David Perdue, former senator, former CEO of Reebok and Dollar General, lost his bid for re-election in that famous January 5th election runoff earlier this year. He's now challenging Brian Kemp for the governorship in Georgia. And Perdue has gone on record saying that if he had been governor, he would never have certified the election results the way Brian Kemp did, even though Georgia recounted the votes three times. You have a similar position being staked out by the Republican frontrunner for Arizona's governor, Carrie Lake. She said hell no when she was asked if she would have certified Joe Biden's victory in Arizona, even though Arizona has had multiple recounts, including one done by people who favored Donald Trump that actually ended up increasing the number of votes for Joe Biden. So again, we're having a situation in which candidates are unwilling to tell people what they need to know and are instead telling them what they want to hear. And that is a recipe for disaster.
So we carry through with another chapter of the reality distortion field.
That we do, Bob. Let's turn our gaze, Bob, and look toward Russia, where President Vladimir Putin is scheduled to deliver his annual Constitution Day address amid rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine. Recent intelligence reports show that upward of 100,000 Russian troops are on the move near the Russian-Ukrainian border. In social media footage appears to show tanks and military equipment moving west on trains. So what do we know at this point, Bob?
Beyond the intel reports you mentioned, there are any number of open source satellite, you know, images of Russian military staging areas, materiel, tanks, transports, and so forth. And Russia has not really denied that they're there either, even though some of them were seemed to have been installed overnight or in the darkness of night. But what Russia does say is that it is coping with an unacceptable threat coming from Ukraine and by proxy through NATO, where it's basically saying, you know, the looming prospect of Ukraine entering NATO would then permit the staging of NATO armaments and troops and so forth in Ukraine, and that would pose an unacceptable threat to Russia, basically creating this sense of threat that Russia is obliged to respond to, and whipping up concern in a way that is reminiscent of what Putin and the Kremlin did before the annexation of Crimea and the actions that stirred a secessionist movement and a fight that is still going on in eastern Ukraine. That fight, by the way, continues to this day. There are just recent reports just in the last 24 hours of a number of skirmishes. It has killed an estimated 14,000 people. So for one thing, there is a conflict going on in eastern Ukraine, Jim, that Russia is backing in terms of backing the separatist side. But this week, we should note there was a two-hour summit call between Presidents Biden and Putin, where by all accounts, they laid out on the table the concerns and the issues using some of the Cold War language of frank and open exchange. But then the takeaways seemingly markedly different, you know, where President Biden talked about the laying out the threats to Russia if any invasion of Ukraine would involve a strong economic response like Russia has never seen. And he said that Putin got the message. Putin, on the other hand, said that he had conveyed his concerns about eastward expansion of NATO and that there were going to be follow-up talks to that extent. And so I think what we're really looking for now, Jim, in addition to the Constitution Day address, where you can expect Putin to reiterate Russia's sort of relationship with Ukraine and Ukraine's sort of inalienable part of Russia. The wording will be very interesting, by the way. You should expect some more language about Russia, you know, sort of defending its territorial integrity and looking out for its own rights. And for there to be some sort of movement on the diplomatic front to sort of re-engage this issue of security in Eastern Europe and what exactly that involves, because there's a great deal of sort of hand-wringing right now, certainly among policy experts in the area about whether or not the U.S. president is going to cave into Russian demands, whereas, you know, U.S. and other officials have said Russia does not have a veto on NATO membership.
Bob, I will note that the White House has been clear to say that the United States is not considering sending troops to defend Ukraine. I believe the phrase is, it's not on the table. I should also note that Putin last summer wrote a very long essay about the importance of Ukraine to Russia and how they were inextricably linked. So this is an issue that's been building up for some time. But I am curious, Bob, to get your sense of what a war would look like if one were to happen. I think most people have in mind sort of a vision of World War II, where Russian troops would march to Kyiv and conquer the entire country. But we have seen in Russian behavior under Putin much more limited kinds of military incursions. I'm thinking, for instance, of the invasion of Georgia in 2008, which did not go all the way to Tbilisi, basically just carved off a chunk of the country. So has anyone given any sense to how they think this might play out?
There's been a few prognostications on this, Jim, and some of it has to do with capabilities on the the Russian-Ukrainian side, and some of it has to do with expectations and intentions. So the most recent Economist magazine sort of looked at and said, there should be no illusion. Russia is the dominant military power here. And if you just look at the way its effective air campaign in Syria, for example, and what it can do on a largely air defenseless Ukraine, it would be very potent just from the air. It could send in tanks and cover large swaths of the country. But in terms of waging an extended campaign in Ukraine or annexing a large chunk of Ukraine up to Kiev or outside of Kiev, that seems to be a lot more of a tougher challenge, frankly. And there seem to be a lot of expectations on the Russian side that Ukrainians would embrace a Russian move into the country, like ethnic Russians in Crimea seemingly embraced the annexation of 2014, Jim. And at the same time, Ukraine has built up its military capability from what it was 7 or 8 years ago. It has benefited from training with U.S. trainers or NATO trainers as well. But it's primarily a land force that could push back, that has some materiel. It's now reported to have support of Turkish drones enter into the fray. But again, you're talking about the dominance of Russian air power, Russian naval power, armored divisions. That will be tough to counter. The longer term, though, is what exactly is Russia going to do to hold that? You're talking about a country that is for 20 years, Ukraine, I mean, seen itself as independent while still very much in Russia's orbit.
Well, you're right, Bob. I mean, Russia, if it were to invade Ukraine, could, let me emphasize, could find itself in the situation of someone trying to swallow a porcupine. You could end up having morass after the invasion. History is littered with such examples. Now, the Russians could obviously think of the invasion of Afghanistan and what that meant for them. But I think, you know, as we look at what's happening in Russia and in Ukraine, one of the hard things to discern is whether this military buildup, which is quite visible, which is clearly known to the Russians that everybody sees it, is a plan of action or a cry for attention, a way to try to extort concessions, diplomatic or otherwise, from the West and from the United States particularly. And again, one of the things you could have in this situation is Russians could dial it down and dial it back up again, because we were in a similar situation back in April with a smaller buildup of Russian troops. So are they probing to wait for the moment, maybe sort of get you to be relaxed? You think, oh, this has happened before, and they back down? Or is it just simply a way to, in some sense, troll the United States in the West? I think the big challenge for the Biden administration is how do you effectively deter the Russians if they are seriously considering an invasion, particularly once you say troops are off the table? Not to say that's the wrong thing to do. I'm not arguing that. But if you're not willing to intervene militarily, then you're leaning back on the issue of sanctions. And it's not at all clear how effective sanctions will be as a deterrent to the Russians, in good part because there are already lots of sanctions on the Russian economy, and the Russians may decide the game is in fact worth the candle. And of course, hovering over all of this for the Biden administration will be the knock-on effects if we were to see a Russian invasion of Ukraine, because everybody's thinking about the threats coming from Beijing toward Taiwan. And again, the United States in Taiwan, as in the case of Ukraine, has no mutual security treaty. We have not committed ourselves to come to their defense, but it's not too hard to imagine that if Ukraine were to be invaded, it would raise lots of questions about what the United States would do if China invaded Taiwan. That would have ripple effects for the whole U.S. alliance structure in East Asia.
Both the military card and to some extent the energy card, Putin continues to play very well. The question is whether the energy portion of that could be somehow punished in such a way that would give them pause or not, Jim. And there's no necessarily proof that it would. I do think it's a good point, as you raised, about getting the attention-getting aspect of this. The springtime buildup, we should note, yielded a summit, and it was Putin meeting Biden before the Chinese president did, even after the U.S. had identified China as its biggest challenge geopolitically. So I think there's a lot of that in this as well. There's certain seems to be a diplomatic flurry going on, but the administration at the same time is pretty uncategorical in saying it would not be putting boots on the ground in response to a Russian invasion of Ukraine.
High-stakes diplomacy, Bob.
Well, Jim, we've talked our way into the audience figure of the week section of the podcast. Listeners can vote on those or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected the India-Russia trade deal. So, Jim, why is that significant?
Well, Bob, I should point out it's not a trade deal, but 28 agreements on trade and arms.
So that's our figure, 28 this week.
It's really 28. And again, these agreements were inked when President Putin visited New Delhi this week and met with Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Now, I have to say, Bob, Bob, right at the top, there's a lot less here than meets the eye. It does not mean that India is turning its back on the United States or that New Delhi is embracing Moscow and we have a new Indian-Russia axis. But first, the details for people who like that sort of stuff. On the commercial side, the two countries pledged to boost international trade by $30 billion by 2025. A Russian oil company is going to supply the Indian oil company with up to 2 million tons of oil by the end of 2022. Russia has agreed to send India an uninterrupted supply of coal to support its steel production. Of course, that's a bad thing for people who are hoping to see less emission of carbon dioxide. On the military side, the two countries signed a military and technical cooperation pact that will last for a decade. India also got the right to produce 600,000 Kalashnikov assault rifles. And it was announced that a 2018 contract under which Russia agreed to provide India with the S-400 anti-aircraft missile system is now going into effect. In fact, shipments started this month. The two sides also issued a joint statement saying they intend to strengthen defense cooperation, including in the joint development of production of military equipment. Now, again, it's real easy to overstate the importance of these agreements. I think people need to keep in mind that India and Russia, and before that, the Soviet Union, had cordial relations for decades. Both are members of the BRICS alignment, but cordial doesn't necessarily mean deep or passionate. Russia, I should point out, is not among India's 20 largest trading partners. Even if bilateral India-Russia trade reached $30 billion, and that's a long shot, that would be only about 5% of India's overall total trade. In terms of military sales, Russia, and before that, the Soviet Union, was a major arms supplier for India. Indeed, India's highest-ranking military official died this week when a Russian helicopter he was flying in crashed. One of the consequences of having a long-standing supply relationship with someone is that it's often easier to buy their weapons for reasons having to do with interoperability. Things work together much better. There is some element of the Indian military establishment that wants to avoid becoming dependent upon the United States or other Western suppliers because you never know what might happen down the road. Want to keep a little bit of wiggle room there. Now, there is one interesting question here, Bob, and then I'll close, and that is the deal on the S-400 does run the risk that the United States could sanction India because there is a 2017 law aimed at deterring countries from buying Russian military hardware. Indeed, last year, under that law, the United States sanctioned Turkey for buying S-400s, but India isn't Turkey. It's not a member of NATO participating in cutting-edge military development programs, and just as important, it is a bedrock member of the new Indo-Pacific alliance, the Quad, that the Biden administration is championing. So it's hard to see the United States sanctioning India over the S-400 acquisition, even if it makes a number of people in the Pentagon and in the State Department, the White House, unhappy.
Jim, I think that list of contexts is really important, especially the last aspect. We are not looking at India of the non-aligned movement era, which famously would rebuke the U.S. on a number of occasions in the height of the Cold War in terms of its relations with the Soviet Union. But India likes to keep its options open and it likes to keep its relations open. It is unequivocally, though, increased and improved its relationship with the United States.
No doubt about that, Bob, and I would expect that to continue.
Well, that's our look at the swirling geopolitical world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. G7 foreign and development ministers meet in Liverpool. Armenia and Azerbaijan hold peace talks in Brussels, and the presidents of Brazil and Paraguay meet.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Maya Kinn, Anna Shortridge, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.